All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here along with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well, Jay. How about you?
Doing great. Doing great, actually. So, you know, Neil, you and I are both big fans of William F. Buckley.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. I've always enjoyed his writing.
Yeah, his writing is great. Started National Review, one of my favorite conservative magazines. And there's a new book out.
There is a new book out, and it's a very appropriate book because I am, especially this year, actively mourning the absence of someone like William F. Buckley. And this book is A Torch Kept Lit, Great Lives of the 20th Century, which written by William F. Buckley, a collection of his eulogies, and edited, put together by James Rosen, who is here with us today.
Yes, Fox News' James Rosen. James, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate this. So I've been looking over the book, and I've started reading. I haven't read through all of it yet, but it's fascinating. And kind of give us some background on how you came to do this project and you know, what brought it on.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. A Torch Kept Lit, Great Lives of the 20th Century. That's the name of the book. It collects 50 of the eulogies that William F. Buckley Jr. either delivered at actual memorial services or published across his extraordinary career. And these are extraordinary pieces. Bill Buckley knew most of the people that we're talking about and or had personally corresponded with them. And he was, of course, a best-selling novelist in addition to his other accomplishments. And so Buckley uses his novelistic gifts to conjure the departed one last time, to allow the reader to savor them as he personally knew these people. There's a section for presidents of the United States. Ronald Reagan, of course, identified William F. Buckley Jr., the founder of the modern conservative movement, the founder of National Review, the host of Firing Line, syndicated columnist, best-selling author. Ronald Reagan identified William F. Buckley Jr. as the most influential journalist and intellectual of our times. And indeed, Ronald Reagan credited Buckley and National Review with converting him from liberalism to conservatism. So they had a very close relationship, and the eulogy that William F. Buckley wrote for Ronald Reagan is a very moving piece. There's also a section for members of the world of arts and letters. And here we find Bill Buckley summing up the lives of such figures as John Lennon, Elvis Presley, Johnny Carson. I'd like to say, in fact, that A Torch Kept Lit is the only place in the world where you will find the conservative economist Milton Friedman right up alongside Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. And such was Bill Buckley's breadth and view of the 20th century. There's even a section that I love. There's one for his friends. There's one for his family members. But there's one called Nemeses. And these are the people that William F. Buckley did battle with over the course of his career. People like Alger Hiss, the convicted Soviet spy. John V. Lindsay, the liberal Republican mayor of New York City during the period of its greatest decline. Nelson Rockefeller, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. And here the fun is to watch Buckley struggle to find something kind to say about these people, or alternatively, not even bothering. In short, if you love history, if you love politics, if you love pop culture, art, music, sailing, spy novels, or the conservative movement itself, this is a book for you.
And I think one of the things that I really liked about these eulogies is, like, you were saying, it's like their honesty. He's just, you know, Buckley didn't, if he didn't like the person or he didn't respect their point of view, he wasn't going to sugarcoat it. In fact, when I read Ayn Rand's eulogy they wrote, and he starts off, Ayn Rand is dead, so incidentally is the philosophy she sought to launch dead. It was, in fact, stillborn. so he didn't.
Well, that's true also. These are not always celebratory, and even for some revered figures in the conservative firmament. So, for example, Winston Churchill.
Yes.
I was going to bring up the Churchill.
So was I. That's great. Go ahead,
yeah,
James. Sorry.
I mean, here in his eulogy for Churchill, William F. Buckley actually saw Churchill speak in person, and he celebrated the accomplishments of Winston Churchill up through and including the victory in World War II. But thereafter, Buckley is pretty critical on Winston Churchill for continuing to stay in office at Penn Downing, even though he lacked the physical stamina to prosecute the Cold War fully,
right,
with the result that something like one-third of the world's population at the time wound up behind the Iron Curtain. A similar case in point would be Buckley's eulogy, which is included in A Torch Kept Lit, for Martin Luther King Jr. Today, we only remember Martin Luther King in the most gauziest of terms, but at the time of his assassination in April 1968, King had been a fierce critic of American involvement in Vietnam and of America's role on the world stage in general. And that is reflected in Buckley's column, which he wrote as a eulogy for Martin Luther King. I would say one further thing. There is a strong theme throughout, notwithstanding those critical sections, there's a strong theme throughout this book of friendship. Buckley had a genius for friendship. He cultivated friendships intensely, and over decades' time, the very last of the eulogies that he ever published before passing away himself was for his longest standing and best friend of some 60 years, Van Galbraith, who had been President Reagan's ambassador to France. And I dare say that those of our listeners who give A Torch Kept Lit as a gift, whatever the occasion, will find that it actually serves to deepen their friendships with the recipients.
Yeah, it's really a wonderful, and I love the way you kind of introduce each one of them. You kind of give a little bit more background, so it's not just kind of like, here, read it. You know, there's some other information in there. So and for anybody that is concerned about, you know, oh, I'm going to read a bunch of eulogies, Buckley's writing is just so good, and he's so well versed in who he's talking about, because even somebody like John Lennon, which I had read, you know, it was this kind of thing where he wanted to gain some kind of understanding of why people felt so sad that this man was dead, because, you know, Buckley admits, he goes, I had no attachment to him. I had no attachment to his music, his lyrics, his anything that he had done, but I wanted to understand why people were like that. And it's funny as well. A lot of these are funny when he talks about Lennon. He says, when he read a two-part profile of John Lennon published in Rolling Stone, he goes, I cannot remember a worse reading experience. there were things like
that. He was referring to the bilious interview that John Lennon gave to Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone, which was really right after the breakup of the Beatles and perhaps John Lennon at his most acidic. And Buckley devoted a column to reading the entire interview. You know, the subject of the Beatles is a fascinating one in this connection, because perhaps the most spectacular reversal that Bill Buckley committed in his entire career was on the subject of the Beatles. When the Beatles came to America in 1964, Buckley wrote a column saying that they were not merely awful, but god-awful, and would go down in the history of music in a way analogous to how the anti-popes go down in the history of Catholicism. And Buckley later said he received five times as many angry letters about that one column as he did on any other subject he ever wrote about. By 1968, however, in a column entitled How I Came to Rock, Buckley acknowledged that there is, in the case of the Beatles, an exuberance that is unmatched anywhere else and that they're simply irresistible. But he did note in this eulogy that he wrote for John Lennon after his assassination in 1980 that he himself, Buckley, was not moved by the lyrics or the music. But as he surveyed the scenes of these crowds of 100,000 people in Central Park in New York, weeping and holding candles at that time, he was moved to pronounce that the grief is real, and it behooved those who were not fans of the Beatles to understand why there was such a profound display.
Right.
Well, and that's one of the things that I kept, you know, coming back to and thinking about as I read through the book, is that Buckley managed to weave together these really profound insights about humanity and the individuals that he was writing about. It really was able to bring a lot of wisdom to that, and also, I think, a lot of humility to his subject. And I think that's partially responsible for why these eulogies are so enduring as literary works.
It partly is Buckley's literary gift, yes. Partly, I think there's a real hunger in America today, given the toxic political climate, for prominent figures who could bring to political discourse a certain civility and wit. And I'm pleased to tell you that there is manifest evidence of this hunger in the fact that A Torch Kept Lit has reached the top five of Amazon and the New York Times bestseller list.
Ah, congratulations.
So it's been a real honor for me just to even have my name on the same book jacket as William F. Buckley's, but to return him to the New York Times bestseller list where he once boasted that he maintained a small apartment.
Well, you know, you say there is a hunger for a writer like that, but where's the where's that hunger going to be satisfied? You know, I look around and I think it's very difficult for someone to speak with grace and understanding of, say, their political nemesis these days. So, do you see anybody or any indications that William F. Buckley's role could ever be filled?
It would be impossible, simply for the same reason that there could not be another Beatles today, because each of those acts, if you will, changed things so profoundly that there was not a need for another one of them. When Bill Buckley came along, he used his good looks, his wit, his debating skills that he had honed at Yale, his family fortune, to create National Review, to launch Firing Line, and in essence, to make conservatism palatable in the media age. There were next to nobody else available as conservatives to go on television or to speak publicly and be received well when Buckley started out. And when he made the cover of Time magazine in 1967, there was a David Levine caricature of him, and the headline, William F. Buckley, Conservatism Can Be Fun. Now, of course, we don't suffer from any deficit of conservative pundits, amusing and otherwise, but there could never be a single conservative pundit with the same kind of reach and influence of Bill Buckley, both because of his singular qualities and the way that the news and entertainment and shall we say the content industries are configured today. But that's not to say we can't use steady doses of civility and wit in our discourse.
I absolutely agree. I think that everyone out there who aspires to write in politics should read William F. Buckley, write of politics, or just write in general, should read him, because he just brings this wonderful humanity to his writing as well. But one of the things that I also like about this book, and here I'm going to talk about your writing, is I love the editor's notes at the beginning of each eulogy, because you are able to provide, in many cases, an amusing anecdote or something that fleshes out Buckley's life or the life that he shared with friends or associates. And I found some of those just absolutely fascinating. And one in particular stuck out to me, and this was the Ronald Reagan chapter, where William F. Buckley said that he was way behind in apprehending his potential, speaking of Ronald Reagan, which just, that struck me. If someone like William F. Buckley can miss Ronald Reagan's potential at first glance, you know, what lessons can we derive from that?
Well, that was in a conversation that Buckley had with Nelson Rockefeller. And amazingly, given where Rockefeller existed on the ideological spectrum, it fell to him to set Buckley straight about the potential of Ronald Reagan, saying that anyone who wins the California governorship with more than a million votes is presidential timber. but I think that, of course, Buckley changed his mind over time about Reagan. What it says, too, is that... again, we have to take stock of the times in which Buckley lived. The information overload that we get today about even the most minor down-ballot candidates and primary challengers, they didn't have back in 1967. And, of course, again, Reagan changed things considerably by being a former actor who could win political office. Today we have as our Republican nominee someone who is a former reality show star and a real estate magnate. We're not entirely shocked by this, but the idea of an actor running for the presidency back in 1967 probably was kind of shocking. So I think that's what that particular passage tells us.
Interesting. So, let me ask James, when you kind of thought about doing this project, I mean, normally, and maybe I'm wrong, but normally you see something like this. A lot of times it's somebody who is already a writer for a magazine, and you're a little different. You're a television journalist. And so now you're doing this, editing this book on a famous conservative writer. So what was, when you kind of, I guess you probably had talks with friends or family or somebody said, I have an idea about this book. I want to do this. Or were you approached, or was it your idea? And what kind of reaction did you get when you first thought about it?
So this project began in late 2012 when I was researching an essay for National Review that was eventually published in January 2013 on the centenary of Richard Nixon. And I was trying to find a specific column that William F. Buckley had written about Nixon called "Is Nixon One of Us?", meaning a movement conservative. I was laboring under the misapprehension that this had been published in National Review with the aid of a book published in 2002, 6 years before Buckley's death, entitled William F. Buckley Jr., A Bibliography, which was basically an index of all of his writings. I was able to discover that, in fact, this article by Buckley had been published in 1971 in the New York Times Magazine. When I was looking through that bibliography of his works, one of the editors said almost as an aside that someday somebody should prepare an anthology of Buckley's eulogies because they were really terrific works of writing. I thought, well, why not me? And I have a long history with National Review, having written on and off for them since 1992, mostly on historical subjects. Of course, I knew Buckley, and he really gave me my start in journalism. And I brought the idea to National Review. They approved of it. There was some delay in that simply because there were some other projects they had going in the pipeline. But the entire thing really took shape over the last year or so. I relied on the digital archives of National Review to search for his eulogies. I located about 220, 230 of them over the course of his career. I also used a website maintained by Hillsdale College, which features great PDF scans of Buckley's works, literally the actual typed column that would be sent to the syndicate that syndicated his column.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's excellent.
And that's a great resource. And as it happened, quite coincidentally, last October, I began work on the book while teaching a two-week journalism seminar at Hillsdale College. The other institution that was very helpful was the Hoover Institute, in California, which maintains control and custody over the complete corpus of firing line tapes and films, and online has a synopsis for each episode, complete with quotes. So I was able to use that when I was writing the overall introduction to the book and the little mini introductions that you were just describing that appear before each of the eulogies. It was a great pleasure to do it. I learned so much about the 20th century and about Bill Buckley. I regret to say that there was more material than we had space for, and so as a result, we had to leave out some eulogies for individuals who were very prominent in the development of National Review or who were very meaningful people to William F. Buckley, ranging from the likes of Daniel Patrick Moynihan and William Sloan Coffin to Hubert Humphrey, Clare Booth Luce, and all kinds of folks, including some very influential people in the development of conservatism in America. But the table of contents that remains provides an extraordinary sweeping view of the 20th century and the great and evil figures that Buckley knew. And his literary gifts were so great, his use of a light comic touch at times, that often these are emotionally devastating pieces.
Yeah, it really is. And you said you knew him. What? I mean, can you give us...
First off, let me just say I'm incredibly envious.
So am I. Yeah, we're very jealous here. So as soon as you say you knew him, I say, okay, I've got to ask about, what was it like to kind of spend time with him and what was he like as a person in person? We always get to see the public persona, and I don't think Buckley was one to be, in my view, probably not much different than you actually saw him on firing line or somewhere else. But still, in person, people are somewhat different. So what was your impression of him when you got to meet him, got to know him?
I got to meet and know Bill Buckley because when I was a student at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, there was a nearby used bookstore, and that bookstore had several of Buckley's books, the anthologies of his columns and so forth, for sale, and each of them had a sticker plate inside of it, was signed but to the same individual year after year by Buckley. So I bought one. And I thought, all right, I now have Bill Buckley's autograph.
Wow.
And then a few years later, I was in my native New York at a used bookstore there, and there I found a book that had been inscribed to William F. Buckley by the author. And I bought it, and I wrote a cheeky letter to him, and he was grateful to receive it back and asked if I would like to come meet him at the National Review offices in New York. I tell this story at the beginning, or at the beginning of the acknowledgement section in the book, In A Torch Kept Lit. And from there, he wanted to know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I was very young. I told him I had a strange and perverse ambition to write a book about Watergate, and specifically a biography of Attorney General John Mitchell, still to this day the highest-ranking U.S. official ever to serve a prison sentence, and a key figure in the rise, reign, and ruin of Richard Nixon. And he, of course, had Buckley had known John Mitchell. He basically, there on the spot, gave me a grant of $5,000 to get started on such a book when I was, you know, flabbergasted and telling him that I didn't want him to think that I'd established this meeting for mercenary purposes. No, he said. He then arranged for me to get my first article anywhere published, which was in National Review. And I kept in touch with him sporadically over the following years. In the year 2000, I interviewed him for over an hour at his mansion on the Upper East Side of Manhattan with three Fox News cameras in tow. I can tell you a lot of funny stories about that, but I'll share just one in the interest of time. And I want you to know that on this occasion, I did the impersonation for him, and he actually told me that's pretty good. At one point, you know, Buckley came from a well-off family. He married into a well-off family. He was an avid yachtsman and sailor. He wrote best-selling books about his voyages with his friends across both the Atlantic and the Pacific. This was October of 2000. And so I said to him at one point, Mr. Buckley, when was the last time that you felt insecure about something? Anything at all? Financially insecure, emotionally insecure, in a bad neighborhood after dark, anything at all? And he thought earnestly for a second, and he said, oh, well, there have been some rather anxious moments at sea. There was one particularly horrific squall that came through. I wasn't entirely sure we weren't going to drown. And I said, what year was that, sir? And he just looked at me earnestly and said, 1958. Okay, so let's recap. I've just asked you, when was the last time you felt a twinge of insecurity about anything at all under the sun? And you have to dimly hearken back 42 years in the past. That is a life well lived. He was very generous. And if you have time for another story, I'll tell you something truly fantastical that has happened to me as a result of publishing this book. I'll spare you the ins and outs of it, but bottom line is, on the very day, the very week where I was informed by the good folks at Crown Publishers that A Torch Kept Lit had made the New York Times bestseller list, and they said, congratulations, you've returned Bill Buckley to the New York Times bestseller list. I received in my hands a VHS tape of that interview I had done with Buckley. Now, I didn't need the VHS tape. Fox News has the complete raw footage of the entire thing. We have the shows on which it aired and so on. But someone offered to send it to me because they'd come across it in someone's files. And so I received in the mail a VHS cassette tape, just like they used to look with the Maxell blue slipcase cover or whatever. And I took out the video cassette just to look at it, and out tumbled a card. This is last week, which was powder blue colored index card. It had National Review William F. Buckley stationery at the top of it. And there scrawled in red ink in Buckley's largely illegible handwriting, it said, for James Rosen, please return. I hope I didn't screw up! B. And so the man probably never ever, at any other time, wrote my name out, okay, in ink or anything else. But this reached me literally the same week, 16 years after he wrote it, after it was stashed away in some hoarding situation, the very week that I returned him to the New York Times bestseller list, and it said, for James Rosen, please return. I hope I didn't screw up. B. It really almost was like a communication from the grave or from the heavens. And it's just truly fantastical.
They call it
and
serendipity.
Another of the reasons why I feel so honored to have done this, and another of the reasons, accordingly, why both of you should be jealous of me.
Well, yeah, that's a given. Without a
and
doubt,
and
so.
Believe me, I'm even more jealous now than I was when you started.
30
you
seconds
know.
Ago, right?
One thing we do have in common, though, and this is kind of fun, is finding signed William F. Buckley books in used bookstores. I was in a used bookstore in Greensboro, North Carolina. I think it's called Edward McKay, and I was paging through, and they had a politics section. I pulled out Gratitude, Reflections on What We Owe to Our Country, which, but it was signed by William F. Buckley, and I got it for, I stole it, basically. It was ridiculous. I don't think they realized that it was inscribed, so, victory.
Well,
there you go.
Now, since we're in the land of trivia and one-upmanship,
I'm going to lose this close
this, but the publisher of National Review, Jack Fowler, whose permission, along with that of Christopher Buckley, was necessary for this book to go forward in the first place, had been holding on to some sticker plates signed by William F. Buckley that are generic, just the signature. And he slapped one into a copy of A Torch Kept Lit. So now I have a copy of A Torch Kept Lit, published posthumously by William F. Buckley, with me as the editor, signed by William
him.
F. Buckley.
That's
so,
awesome.
You know, I'm going to make sure that goes straight into the bank vault, pretty much.
Absolutely, that is really great. So, James, we got a few minutes here. Tell us here's a question, because you said there were some of the eulogies that couldn't be made. There's about, I guess that's right. You said there's around 50 of them in the book. Is that right?
There's a little over 50.
But you
right.
said you found several hundred.
About 230 that he had written.
Okay. So what was the process like to go and like eliminate some of those for space purposes to say, okay, well,
brutal.
We can't have this one.
Brutal.
Got yeah.
I mean, it was tough. Like we had a whole section just for that was titled Movement Conservatives, where Buckley paid tribute to and summarized the lives of some really important characters. But we, Crown was very strict about the space limitations, and so we had to rescue a few folks from that section and create a kind of conservative movement, conservatives diaspora, where we sprinkled them into other sections. For example, Barry Goldwater, Russell Kirk, and otherwise had to excise the remainders, each of whom for each of whom I had created prefatory notes. Who knows, maybe there'll be interest in a sequel or through National Review, and for subscribers we'll do something where they can read some more of these along with prefatory notes. But it was a very brutal process. The correspondence between Bill Buckley and William Sloan Coffin was hilarious. An example of what Buckley called one of his trans-ideological friendships. As we were discussing at the beginning, when we were talking about civility and wit and politics, Buckley was able to be terrific friends with liberals who disagreed with him squarely on just about every issue, but with whom he went skiing every year, with whom he went on the Today Show to debate every year. Unfortunately, you know, we can't include all of these extraordinary pieces of writing. As I say, it was a brutal process. But the book that results is so jam-packed with wonderful writing. Christopher Buckley, who's the only child of Bill and Pat Buckley, and who counts as a kind of a supreme witness to their lives and their intentions and their capabilities and so forth, he provides a blurb on the back cover of A Torch Kept Lit, in which he says, "I have read every single one of my father's 60-odd books. I do not exaggerate to propose that A Torch Kept Lit may prove to be the finest of them." And for your listeners, if they want to check out some of the materials in the book, you can go to atorchkeptlit.com. And there you can order the book in any format and see little excerpts from Bill Buckley's eulogy for Ronald Reagan, his eulogy for Johnny Carson, on whose Tonight Show Buckley was a guest 21 times, or excuse me, 12 times, I think, in 21 years. Go to atorchkeptlit.com and you can find excerpts from these things. And
definitely do that.
Yeah, definitely. You'll have a 1 to 3 week wait on Amazon. That's how popular the book is right now.
Yeah, we've sold out. We're going into, I think, our fifth printing. And, it's going to have New York Times bestseller on the cover. I'm not one of those people who bears a grudge against the New York Times, but then acquiesces in the publication on subsequent editions of my books. New York Times bestseller. I'm quite happy to have New York Times bestseller in the on the jacket.
Well, and actually, I read through the Abe Rosenthal eulogy in the book, and which Buckley praised the New York Times. I think, what did he say about it? That it was the finest newspaper in human history, or the finest
news organization in human history.
That's what
even
it was.
Even as Buckley could be very critical of some of their columnists, like Scotty Reston and others, for being what he termed Soviet apologists. Again, we don't have in politics today the kind of civility and trans-ideological bonding going on that we see within the pages of A Torch Kept Lit.
Right. He was very critical of the New York Times for the obituary that they did of Alger Hiss, which was very, they just glossed over his spying and kind of made it seem like it was just more of, the title and everything that they gave for it. He was found a little offensive because it understated what he had done. But then, like you said, the fact that he could be friends with different people of different political backgrounds just kind of shows, like, you're right, that the culture is so much different then than it is now. It's like now it would almost be unheard of for a conservative to be friends with somebody who's a liberal. I mean, I have liberal friends, and I think probably some of us do, but it's almost
looked
down upon.
Well, it needn't be unheard of, Jay.
No, I know that. I'm saying.
One of the many lessons that we can draw from
Absolutely.
Buckley's writing and is that we can have these trans ideological friendships. And
I went on a trip to the Mideast with Secretary of State John Kerry in 2013, and I got permission in this, because our discussion was off the record, to relate this in the book, in A Torch Kept Lit, in the introduction to the eulogy for John Kenneth Galbraith, the liberal economist who was President Kennedy's ambassador to India and one of Bill Buckley's best friends. And in a quiet moment in Egypt, I asked Secretary Kerry over wine and cheese, by the way, did you know Bill Buckley? And he said, I loved Bill Buckley. I said, why is that, sir? And he said, do you know who his best friend was? I said, who is that? He said, I said, John Kenneth Galbraith. He said, that's right. He said, do you know how they knew each other? I said, well, they would go skiing once a year together. He says, that's right. And he said, that's what's missing from politics today. And he's right. And by the way, John Kerry was a guest on Firing Line, and which was a show, again, where Buckley was unafraid to mix it up. He had as guests people like Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg and Muhammad Ali and Jack Kerouac and John Kenneth Galbraith and Allard Lowenstein. These were liberals of the era and who almost uniformly, I think, came away from their appearances on the set of Firing Line with Bill Buckley thinking that was enriching. That was enlightening. Would that more people left television sets for political talk shows today thinking that was enriching, that was enlightening.
Normally doesn't happen. All right. Well, James, we really want to thank you again for being on and appreciate you taking the time to do this. Before you go, there is one question we have to ask you, and we always promise our guests that, we kind of like to have the conversation format that we did. And we don't spring any kind of gotcha questions on you, except for one.
I was young. I needed the money. I'll just say it right now, whatever the question is. I was young. I needed the money.
It's not that kind of question.
It's not that kind of question. You don't have to worry about that. This is a question that we're doing, and you're actually going to be the first guest that's going to get this question. We've done these kind of either-or things. And
there are a series of battles that Jay and I wage, and we can never quite resolve them. And so we've decided to enlist the help of our guests, and we've asked the question, this is a very important cultural question, which also happens to be a binary choice. Are you prepared?
And therefore go ahead, completely invalid. Please, I will be happy to adjudicate this for you.
Very good.
Great.
The question is, which is better, Star Trek or Star Wars?
Of course, clarity is needed in the formulation of the question, with the result that we would know whether you mean Star Trek, the entire franchise, or the original TV run, or Star Wars, the original movie that bore that title, or the entire franchise, and so forth.
Let's say franchise the franchise.
Yes.
We agree that that's a legitimate question, right, for me to pose in reply?
Absolutely.
Indeed. Okay.
Yes.
And the answer to my question is?
Franchise v. franchise. So Star Trek as a franchise versus Star Wars as a franchise. The sum totality of every produced work in the two.
Yeah.
Well, not knowing which of you clings tenaciously to which franchise, I therefore risk alienating one of you terribly, I suspect.
No. But this won't change our perception of you in the slightest bit.
All right. Good. All right. Well, I would say, hands down, Star Wars as a franchise, which actually... there we are. Play the Imperial theme, which my son can play on guitar. I think Star Trek, the television show, was important for a number of reasons, which we all know. But Star Wars is more enduring and I think just represents a greater, higher plane of artistry in general. Does that make
sense?
There
you have it.
Well, James, I appreciate your insights into this important topic, even though I am bitterly disappointed.
And here I thought it was going to be Beatles or Stones. Killing me.
Oh, you know, we're thinking about doing that
later,
one.
but we already knew which way you'd go on that one.
Yes, indeed,
that would be too easy. All right.
Again, they're all false. They're all false binary options. You know.
Oh, of course.
I love the Stones, and I've derived enjoyment from both Star Trek and Star Wars. Though I would hasten to add, I am not a Trekkie per se, because that comes freighted with all kind of connotations.
But, yeah, it does.
Yeah, if they're going pound to pound, franchise versus franchise, you know. Simply in numerical gross dollar terms, right? Star Wars far outpaces Star Trek.
That is also true.
Yes. All right. Well, again, James Rosen from Fox News, we appreciate you being here. This has been a lot of fun and appreciate the stories as well.
Well, for me as well. Thank you, Jay and Neil. I really, you guys are very good to me.
Well, we appreciate that.
We urge all our listeners out there to go ahead and pick up a copy of A Torch Kept Lit when more copies are available.
Yep.
Just go to atorchkeptlit.com. They'll
indeed.
Find them there.
Indeed.
There you go. And for everybody that's listening, hey, if you like this show, and we know some of you do, go out there, subscribe. If you're not already a subscriber, tell other people to subscribe. People should subscribe, right, James? Shouldn't they subscribe to this podcast?
Absolutely.
See that?
And they should have a copy of the podcast in their glove compartments at all times.
There you go. There it is. Matter of fact, what we'll do is if people are nice, James, let me ask you this question. We'll put you on the spot here a little bit. Could we possibly get a signed copy of the book by you that we could give away to one of our listeners?
I would be honored to comply with that. Yes.
All right. See, there you go. So this gives you reason to subscribe because we'll probably spring this on you at some point when you're least expecting it. A signed copy of A Torch Kept Lit from James Rosen. And so subscribe to the website. Leave us a review. We love that. I'm Jay Caruso for Neil Dewing. We will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.